So I want to begin this morning with a story, and it's a story, and I'm beginning with it not because it's necessarily theologically correct or accurate, let's say, but it can move someone to a little bit of self-reflection. And so the story goes that one day God was looking down upon the whole earth, and he was wondering what was going on. So God sends an angel down to earth to kind of see what's happening. Well, the angel comes back, gives this report to God that 95% of the people are mischievous and behaving badly. Well, 5% are good. Well, when God hears this, he thought maybe he needed a second opinion. So he sends down another angel. Sure enough, that angel comes back and says, yes, unfortunately, it's true. The earth is in decline. 95% of the people are behaving badly, and only 5% are good. Well, God was a little distressed. But God decided, you know, to write an email of encouragement to those 5%, right? Trying to give them a good word in the face of such adversity. So God sent out the email. And you know what the email said? No, I didn't get the email either, but I was just wondering if maybe somebody else had. But then again, you know, how we understand our goodness and how God sees our goodness, they really are two different things. I mean, in the scriptures, you know, the whole creation, human beings, they're described as being inherently good. God calls, even at times, saying that it's very good. And that human beings are good and that we are capable of good. But that doesn't mean we always choose the good or even see the good. I mean, instead of seeking and naming and choosing goodness, and the goodness that can be bestowed upon us by God, there are times where we look in other places in order to find life's value. Right? So we give up on goodness in the search of other things. And I believe, you see, one of the things that we can often forsake, or when we forsake goodness, one of the things that we're actually chasing after instead is greatness. You see, and it's the kind of greatness that seeks to separate a person from another, set us apart from somebody else. It becomes an expression of one's superiority or one's importance, this quest for greatness. And you see, the scriptures are full of stories of people, individuals who forsook goodness and instead went in search of greatness, or they confused one with the other. I mean, in many ways, that's what's at the heart of the story of the fall in the Garden of Eden, right? When Adam and Eve ate of the fruit of the tree of knowledge, right? They believed when they ate of that, the fruit of that tree, that they would no longer need God, right? Or they wouldn't need that goodness that came from God by being in a relationship with God. Instead, they chose to feed their own sense of self-importance, believing that they would be like God. You see, greatness, their own greatness, was more important. And another figure in Scripture who follows a similar path is King Herod. This King Herod, there were a couple of King Herods, but it's this King Herod that we hear mentioned in Matthew's Gospel this morning. This King Herod was actually known as Herod the Great. You see, Herod had risen to become king of Judea, king of the Jews. And as he had done this, in many ways, he abandoned the God of Israel. He abandoned the goodness of that God for the sake of his own greatness in order to become Herod the Great. And so Herod was a guy who climbed the ladder of success. He kept close allegiance and affiliation with the Roman authorities. He worked hard at pleasing Rome and the Roman superiors above him. You know, recently, it was just a couple of years ago, in the city of Caesarea Maritima in Israel, there was an altar they found dedicated to Caesar Augustus, and it was built on the order of King Herod. Because you see, Herod was more interested in himself and his own greatness. He really had abandoned the God of Israel. But still, he managed to attain this power, this wealth, this fame. And thus, in the text from Matthew this morning, when the Magi come to Herod looking for the place where the King of the Jews had been born, it was unlikely that Herod would have favorably received those words and the predictions of the Magi. You see, Herod thought he was entitled to his position. How dare there be another that could somehow compromise his ability to be king? Herod was used to getting rid of people. Herod was used to getting rid of people who got in the way of his aspirations and his ego. He used people to get what he wanted. Herod had a reputation that included things like 10 wives. Herod assassinated people at his at whim, right? He even assassinated some of his own sons that he thought were going to be a threat to his own greatness. And so when Herod finds out that a baby could get in the way of his greatness, he defaulted to his regular pattern, figuring out how to get rid of the problem child by eventually, what does Herod do? He orders the execution of all infant boys in Judea. You see, Herod stands as a reminder in this story of how personal greatness can lead a person to believe they have been given a license to forsake goodness. And this is something Christians need to keep in mind, especially in a world where individualism and the culture of celebrity and personal achievement can get so much attention. I mean, there is this danger of allowing a pursuit for greatness to be more important than goodness. You know, a while ago, I was reading this blog about a man. He was reflecting on his own life. For years, he had worked as an agent in pro sports with pro athletes. And he reflected on how his quest for greatness caused him to lose sight of his goodness, or the goodness of others. And for him, it began as a young man out of college. He started representing some of the athletes that he went to school with. And his clients, as they met success, he became more successful. He started rubbing elbows with more important people. He signed more important clients. And he found himself, as a result, dropping clients that had been friends of his for a long time. But you see, they were no longer of use to him. They were standing in the way of his success and greatness. He started treating himself. He saw himself differently. He started treating others differently. And in his reflection, he says, you know, looking back, he describes it how at first it was just rather innocuous, how it came about. He had made some decisions that had paid off. He was growing in his self-confidence. But he didn't understand how this was coming at the expense of others. So he writes this in his blog. He says, "I realized when you set on the path of being better than you were, when you set on the path of being better than you were before, it changes you, and then it can give you a bigger sense of entitlement." And he goes on to say, he says, you know, when you start achieving more in your life, you start to feel more confident and more powerful as an individual. So naturally, I kept going and going until I reached a level of greatness that was nothing but arrogance. And then he goes on to say, and that's what I want to point out. In the journey you are on, whatever it is, be aware that getting better most of the time is accompanied with getting an inflated sense of entitlement. He said, I've caught myself a lot of times falling into this trap. I started treating those around me with less respect. I became arrogant. I started believing that I was better than them. But in the end, I didn't feel that great at all. and I sank down to a level that wasn't even human. You see, that man's experience ended up with him losing his sense of value as being human, as a human being. And this happens, right? We can lose our sense of goodness, and we can lose sight of the goodness of others because what we're focused on is greatness. I mean, think of the Hollywood producer, Harvey Weinstein. He's going to trial this week, right? He and many others like him were ones we might have categorized as being great people, right? Ones who had achieved a level of success, publicly lauded, famous, wealthy celebrities. They were ones whose positions and whose self-importance put them in a position where they felt entitled to take whatever they wanted and treat people however they felt they wanted to treat them. But in the end, you see, this not only caused pain and suffering towards others, but it has brought these accused individuals down to a level where even we can be unwilling to see goodness in them. This is what happens. Relationships get distorted. Justice is not served. If anything, human life is diminished. And so with that in mind, I want us to turn back to the wise men, to the magi in this text from Matthew. Because they're sort in search for this newborn human life, the one born king of the Jews. Now, we remember that the Magi were in search of greatness when they followed that star. But when they encountered the baby Jesus, what they found, you know, wasn't necessarily greatness. Certainly not the greatness that King Herod embodied. They had just been to visit King Herod. You can imagine what it would have been like walking into Herod's palace. Herod would have been surrounded by advisors, you know, by servants, opulence, wealth. You know, if he said a word, someone was there to cater to his every whim. Well, compare what the wise men and the magi encountered there to what they encounter when they get to the place where Jesus lay. A den fit for animals, but it's there that they kneel down and pay homage, and that they're overwhelmed with joy. It's amazing how the behavior of the Magi changes in the story. Because you see, the Magi are men of power. They were men who could get an audience with King Herod the Great. They were men who could afford to offer gifts, expensive gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. But they were also men who did not let their greatness get in the way. They didn't let their greatness get in the way of them seeing the goodness of Jesus laying in the manger. As the Magi saw it, you know, the child was to bring salvation to the world. And they were filled with hope, and they were filled with joy, and they were filled with good things. They chose to see the good in the manger, and they wanted to see the good. I mean, in the end, they revere the goodness of Christ over the greatness of Herod. Right? They saw what one theologian describes as this. He says, in Christ, grace is not reserved for great people. Grace underscores the goodness of God. A God who is not interested in personal ego or climbing the ladder or attaining a lifestyle, but a God who humbles himself and enters this world and seeks to share life and give life to all people. You see, encountering such goodness in the infant Jesus changes the behavior of the Magi forever. Because after beholding Christ in the manger, the Magi are warned in a dream that they are not to return to Herod, but make their way home on a different road. You see, the wise men could have gone back to Herod, and he may have even rewarded them very well, you know, for the information, telling him where this child was. But But something happens after the Magi encounter Jesus to change their lives, because they're called to go in a different direction, another way home, as it were, as the text puts it. The wise men do not acquiesce to the demands of personal greatness. Instead, there's something about the goodness they encounter in the Christ child that reveals to them there is a different way of navigating life, a different way of journeying through this world, one that would take them home. You know, I read a biography recently about someone else who has encountered this sort of journey, this sort of goodness in his life. I don't know if you've heard of Randy Lewis, but Randy Lewis retired back in 2013 as the senior vice president of Walgreens Pharmacy in the U.S. You heard of Walgreens, some of you? Probably. Well, he wrote this book appropriately titled, No Greatness Without Goodness. And in it, he tells the story of how, when he shifted the focus away from greatness to goodness, not only did it change his perspective on the world, it transformed the corporate culture within which he worked and lived. You see, early on in his career, Lewis, he says he wasn't unlike any other corporate employee. He sought to make targets and separate himself from his peers because he wanted to climb the ladder. It was all about him, his abilities, and his success. But that all changed for Lewis when he and his wife had a son named Austin who was born with autism. So after Lewis started watching the world through his son's eyes, he knew that his world, Lewis's world, and the way he approached the corporate world, he knew things had to be different. I mean, in his autistic son, he saw a goodness and abilities that he knew would never be received or realized in the environment that was more focused on personal greatness. Right? Lewis saw how the lure of greatness, you know, how it just managed to get the best sometimes, but the worst out of a lot of people. It was a great injustice. So as a man of faith, as a Christian, Lewis sought and actually fought through his corporate life to find another way. So out of his work and out of his witness in the world's largest drugstore chain, he produced a global model in proving that disabled employees in large numbers not only match but often exceed their peers in the workplace. And Lewis did this not by needing to be number one, not by seeking to build self-confidence, but by sharing goodness. That's how he puts it. And by nurturing the goodness and the confidence of those around him. And he reflects on the change that took place in his book. And he says, you know, Walgreens really found themselves on a different road after that. He speaks of how managers, instead of focusing on targets, worked on building relationships with employees. Employees sought to work better with each other, right? They were encouraging one another, especially the ones hired with disabilities. It changed the way they related to others. They were more supportive. There wasn't the strain of competition. The workplace became friendlier, more hospitable. Lewis recalls that at board meetings, instead of going over forecasts and financial plans all the time, more time was spent telling stories of employee successes and encounters that led to personal growth and encouragement. Right? Lewis says, looking back on how his faith guided him and transformed him, he says in this in his book, he says, as I enter the dusk of my life, I remember the words of my favorite columnist, Irma Bombeck, who said, when I stand before God at the end of my life, I would hope that I would not have a single bit of talent left and could say, I used everything you gave me. He said, I've learned that life is not about the destination we reach, but about the journey and the goodness of the people we meet along the way. I liken it to something the German reformer Martin Luther said, Because Luther described true faith as a living confidence in the goodness of God. That true faith is a living confidence in the goodness of God. You see, it's not about a personal goodness, a self-confidence. The confidence that comes through our own sense of greatness. It's the confidence that comes from living in God's goodness. We choose that goodness. We can share in that goodness. Because you see, greatness is often associated with personal achievements, maybe even a single achievement, and it can take great energy to maintain. And quite honestly, I think you get to a point in life where sooner or later you got to give up on greatness. And if that's all you're about, then life is over. But we can always choose goodness. You see, and this is the way that Jesus embodied throughout his life. Others were touched by his goodness in unpredictable ways and still are. You know, and we know that his way, it wasn't the way to greatness, because if it was, he wouldn't have ended up on a cross. But through his life, his birth, his death, we have the revelation of a God whose spirit is determined to resurrect goodness in this world, because it is through goodness that we will discover a life that is everlasting. Thanks be to God.